This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond exposes the just transition and dirty deeds done.
If we don't help emerging economies avoid the fossil fuel trap, this civilization will crash over the climate cliff. At COP26 last year, a trial plan was agreed, but somehow the green has turned to black. To get the inside story, we go to Dr. Patrick Bond, professor of sociology at the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. Now, he was born in Northern Ireland. He was educated at a high school in Alabama, got a degree from Wharton, a doctorate at Johns Hopkins. Bond worked for social justice in Philly and D.C., and then went for the big battle for civil rights in South Africa. He played a role advising the new South African government of Nelson Mandela. From Johannesburg, Patrick Bond, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thanks very much for having me, Alex. It's a really important time to talk about the climate, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. You recently returned from the country of Mauritius. What took you there?
Well, there's an amazing progressive movement that works on environment, and it's called Resistance Ec Alternative. And they're extremely good at pulling people from the region, defenders of the Indian Ocean. And this island has had gone through some tough times. I mean, they haven't been hit with the awful cyclones that neighboring Madagascar has. They had three in about a week or so this year, as well as a drought. But they've had shipwrecks in 2021 that actually dumped oil all over. And this group, Resistance Ec Alternative, became famous for finding artisanal boom strategies to keep the oil away. They basically wrapped up the sugarcane husks as well as human hair, and they put several kilometers of these booms to prevent the oil slick from spreading into the very sensitive coral reef areas. And I think one of the most extraordinary things is that they come from a socialist perspective in doing this. It's a very strong tradition of revolutionary socialism, and they've turned to the environment. So if anyone is interested, John Bellamy Foster from Monthly Review is also out and about in Mauritius. And this is the kind of network that I think unites the sort of forces of progressive broad organizing with our region's environmentalists. And the political ecology school was a real treat for me. I learned much more than I could even begin to contribute in my talks.
Yes, but on the other end of the spectrum, the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change met again in Africa, this time in a resort at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Patrick, is that a good place to discuss climate justice?
Well, it's pretty typical, isn't it? I mean, we're going to see them again in the region, Middle East, next year at the United Arab Emirates, Dubai. And this is now becoming a bit of a joke. It's so much so that Greta Thunberg, the Swedish youth activist, decided she wouldn't even bother legitimizing them by showing up. There are plenty of good climate activists there, no question, but they're not allowed to do anything. They have small tokenistic demonstrations, but their ability to lobby is limited. And indeed, the fossil fuel companies have shown up in force, so over 670 delegates. And the major breakthrough, I think, if there is going to be one, is the loss and damage demand. And here in South Africa, we've had extraordinary rain bombs, two that hit Durban, the first one on April 11, killing about 500 people. And the way things are organized, there were very few who were middle class, and they were entirely black residents of Durban, because the shacks and the low-income housing, the areas where people are living near the floodplains and on the hills, are very vulnerable. And so this was one of the ways that the race class aspects of post-apartheid South Africa, even in some ways worse than the apartheid era in terms of poverty, inequality, unemployment, and ecological degradation, really hit home. So loss and damage is very important, partly because very few of the people who were injured or certainly the families of those who lost their loved ones have been compensated. And instead, a major car company, Toyota, has been the main beneficiary of the sort of building back, for example, to put in some stormwater drainage at long last. So this is a kind of good reflection that we hear in South Africa, including with the minister, Barbara Creasy is her name, in charge of the United Nations subcommittee within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, dealing with loss and damage. And she's not well liked here because she has done very, very little to, you know, sort of help on environmental justice and stop pollution that kills a couple of thousand people a year in some of the main pollution hotspots. So in short, we're not too optimistic given that sort of leadership, and that the United States and its, you know, the middle tier allies that you spoke of in the intro, the sort of, I would call them the sub-imperial layer, and that begins with China, the big polluter, which, you know, per person is way, way less than the United States, and historically is far less than the United States. But both of them came out this week to decline to fund loss and damage on grounds that that could open up liability. And so we may see some small amount go to a loss and damage fund, even from some U.S. contributions. But the critical thing that they seem to really want to avoid, and they wrote into the Paris Climate Agreement, is that there's no liability. There's no, let's call it the polluter pays principle. This, the kind of principle, Alex, that has been so widely accepted in your Environmental Protection Agency, that's the basis of the Superfund that was set up in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter to try to get to grips with the huge toxic dumps all over and to charge the companies that polluted. And that simple logic, which is both ethically and economically efficient, it's ethically necessary because the people who've caused the problems, people in the global north, I include myself in a middle-class suburb of Johannesburg, we are just simply not being compelled to pay, and hence the problem continues.
Yes, with the climate disaster gaining on us, the global north must find a way to help with clean renewable energy. So a group of wealthier countries decided on South Africa as a pilot project for a just energy transition partnership. I don't know a lot about it, but Patrick, let's be generous. What was the stated goal and hope of this project?
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I think we could be generous, at least to say what should be the basis for the north paying even a middle-income country, South Africa, the amount $8.5 billion. And we would have hoped it would have been a grant, not further loans, since South Africa's foreign debt already at about $175 billion. Really, we shouldn't be compelled to borrow, especially because the currency is declining rapidly. And if we borrow in a U.S. dollar, the lenders don't take our South African rand seriously. We have to convert to dollars. And as our rand declines, the effective interest rate becomes ludicrously high. So this is one of the major, you know, let's say it's technical detail, but it's one that really affects the price. We also wanted genuine concessional finance, very, very low interest rates. The U.S., of course, being greedy and with the neoliberal agenda of both Joe Biden and his climate czar, John Kerry, they're only giving the market rate loans to South Africa, about 9% a year. And then they're providing guarantees to private lenders from the U.S. who will contribute. So what's this money supposed to be for? If we could be generous, we would say it would be the way that a northern country would pay a southern country to leave fossil fuels underground. And that's the way it was phrased even by the South Africans in the annual nationally determined contributions that they're proposing. These countries say, this is what we'll do. And South Africa's huge coal reserves and 85% reliance for the electricity in the laptop, for example, that I'm talking to you through, that would require us to really make rapid changes to decarbonize, to basically close those coal-fired power plants down early and leave the coal in the hole. We also have gas offshore, and we should not be taking the gas. So in a generous interpretation, the $8.5 billion should be done as a grant in exchange for leaving our fossil fuels underground. We should do it all over. You know, the sort of original idea for this was from Ecuador. It was a place called Yasuni on the Peruvian border in the Amazon, where there was about $10 billion worth of oil in the demand from a then progressive government of Rafael Correa in the 2006-2007, when it got up and running, was that the West would give $3.5 billion, and that would be in grants to the Ecuadorian government, which would use it for social programs. So that's a good way to think about the North paying a down payment, really, a small amount, really, compared to what's owed on the climate debt, and the South saying, okay, so we won't use the atmospheric space that is, you know, really fairly ours to use, but instead of extracting fossil fuels or engaging in a highly fossil dependent development path, we'll take some money and we'll use that to have a different way to empower our people. Unfortunately, the $8.5 billion is going to Eskom mostly, as well as some electric vehicle subsidies to BMW, VW, Mercedes, a few other car companies. Unfortunately, these are companies your listeners may know that cheated on their emissions, and California actually picked up the cheating in the VW scandal in 2015, and it was a really serious scandal. It cost VW 18 billion euros in fines. But they're the ones getting these subsidies, and they're going to export the electric vehicles. There's some talk of green hydrogen. That'll go through a really awful company called Sasol, the second worst polluter. But really, let's talk about what you would do if you wanted to pay this electricity company, it's called Eskom, not to engage in more fossil fuel extraction and not to have not simply coal, but also methane gas plants, which are proposed. Well, unfortunately, the guys that are dealing, and let me name a name in the United States, a famous negotiator called Jonathan Pershing from the U.S. State Department, very close ally of a man called Todd Stern, who Hillary Clinton and then John Kerry depended upon for basically managing the U.S. role in the UN, and they were notorious for refusing to acknowledge climate debt and really refusing to do what was right to cut emissions and adopt any of the climate justice principles. And unfortunately, Jonathan Pershing was put in charge of this. And just before Glasgow, over a year ago, he came to South Africa and organized this $8.5 billion with his mates. And they were from Britain. And then they were hosting Glasgow COP26 and also Germany and France and the EU as a whole. So these five, let's say, governments, EU including, but also separate from France and Germany, with a World Bank component. And they are very self-interested, all of them, in having Eskom get more money. And the reason is they've all lent to Eskom for coal-fired power plants. And the most notorious, Medupi and Kusile, that's the majority of the debt that this company owes. They really shouldn't have been lent any money. These lenders shouldn't have, especially for a coal-fired power plant. But it was known as they were lending that the company, Eskom, the parastatal state agency, was already corrupted by a company from Japan, Hitachi. And the reason we can say this openly, that Hitachi bribed our ruling party, the African National Congress, is because the United States has a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that was actually in 2015 deployed, and Hitachi was prosecuted and successfully was paid a fine, a small fine, about $19 million. Unfortunately, the fine was paid to the U.S., not to our people, our taxpayers, or our government here in South Africa. And this is a real indication that the lenders really shouldn't be collecting. They should take the proverbial haircut on the loan, and we should call that loan an odious debt and repudiate it. And unfortunately, the $8.5 billion is a money that's what we call fungible. It goes into the Eskom treasury, and it goes out in the form of loan repayments, as well as the ambition of the Eskom leader, whose name is André de Ruyter, and he wants to have 44% of the new money coming in to be used for gas plants. And the gas would emanate from Cabo Delgado, Mozambique. It's famous around the world now because it's where Islamic guerrillas, with some strong support in parts of the population, are trying to fight against the extraction. They're guerrillas who don't necessarily have an environmental ideology, but they certainly see that the resource curse of Mozambique, which is right there, the Rovuma Basin, one of the biggest gas fields in the world, has led Total from Paris, Total Energies, as well as ExxonMobil from Houston and Eni from Rome and China National Petroleum Corporation to set up a massive facility for Total. They put in $20 billion, single biggest investment in Africa. And that means if they can go forward with this gas extraction, they'll create a much more climate change through methane, which is 85 times more potent than CO2. And the point being, just to wrap this huge contradiction up, is that this area, the east side of Mozambique and the Mozambique Channel, gets very hot, and the water goes above 30 degrees centigrade, and that means, I can't remember what that is in Fahrenheit, but close to 90, and that means that the cyclones get very serious. So one that hit in 2019, Alex, it's called Cyclone Kenneth, had 225 kilometer per hour winds, the fastest ever recorded in this part of the world. And the one just a month before that, Cyclone Idai, killed a couple of thousand people and went all the way from Mozambique up into Zimbabwe and Malawi. So we're talking about a really serious problem of the climate catastrophe hitting this very area. And this terrible irony that the French and Italian and US and Chinese companies are there. And they, by the way, need protection. They need a local gendarme, local police, and the Mozambique army is useless. And so Emmanuel Macron, the French leader, actually visited both Kigali in Rwanda to see Paul Kagame and Cyril Ramaphosa, our president, in South Africa. That was in May 2021 after a big battle closed down Total. And as a result, we've put 1,000 of our troops, more than 1,000 Rwandans, into, unfortunately, not succeed much in resolving this dispute and not protecting the local people. The guerrillas are getting stronger. The army isn't doing very much. Total isn't confident enough to move back, but they are, through Eni, the Italians, beginning to extract offshore, selling it through BP. And that means we are actually losing this battle on all the fronts involved. And it does mean that if you go to a place like Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, you see the Total Energy's leader is a guy called Patrick Pouyanné, wandering around with a smug confidence that they can just continue business as usual.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We are talking with Patrick Bond from the University of Johannesburg. It seems like Africa is now seen as a big target for more fossil fuel production. The multinational companies that are making trillions of dollars of profits right now want to come in and start fracking, start more oil reserves. It's going to make Africa finally rich, as it always deserved, is their story. But it starts out green and it ends up black, just as I said in the introduction. Do you think that we are insane, or are we going to commit suicide this way, Patrick?
I wouldn't call it suicide, because it's a lot of Africans have no responsibility. It's more a murder, isn't it, by these guys like Patrick Pouyanné. I've studied him, and I have a piece in the current issue of Actuel Marx, a French journal. And Total Energies is particularly notorious, not just Mozambique, and also they have a pipeline, the East African Crude Oil Pipeline, EACOP, along with the Chinese to dig deep into Uganda, the Lake Albert area, and pump out through Tanzania. And so that's a huge battle that is being waged around the world with solidarity against EACOP. And Total then is also very active down our coastline. And we're fighting very hard, both Total and Shell and their local ally, Impact, as well as Petro SA, the local South African company. They are really being defeated by activists on the beaches, literally hundreds of protests over the past year, and tens of thousands of people involved from the fisher folk and the community, the shoreline sort of affected communities, but also the marine conservationists, very sophisticated networks opposed to the seismic blasting, as well as the climate activists. And they come in both climate action and climate justice ideologies. And I've been very impressed. And I go to these beachline protests and to the ones here in Johannesburg in solidarity. And it's in the courts that our extremely good public interest lawyers have actually defeated these big oil companies. However, that means there's more pressure on these oil companies to go dig elsewhere, like next door in Namibia. They found some big gas fields. And as you say, all over the continent, there's more exploration. And the tragic aspect is partly that Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine meant that sanctions, oil and gas and even coal sanctions from Europe, makes the European leaders like Olaf Scholz, German Chancellor, actually physically visit Africa with his charming, smarmy, approach and actually look in Senegal and for gas, in Nigeria for oil, and here in South Africa for coal. His visit in May this year was just appalling, just as he was about to host the G7. And of course, he has a very prominent role in the $8.5 billion just energy transition. So enormous hypocrisy, where the Europeans are saying, no, we should decarbonize, we'll give you some money too. But then they're encouraging more fossil fuel exports to their own coal-fired power plants, which have just been opened up. Look, I hope they can survive this winter, and it's going to be a very, very important period for them to very rapidly move into more renewables and better storage systems. And so maybe in the medium and long term, we can look at this as a blessing in disguise. But what we see in Africa is more stranded assets and co-opted African leaders who've been in Sharm el-Sheikh, basically lobbying to have Africa excused to get a little bit more oil and gas, which, as you observe, they profits go to the elites and to the Western and Chinese oil companies, and they leave the Africans with pollution and underdevelopment and oppression.
Would you believe, Patrick, that we hear about absolutely none of this in the Western media? You know, what you've just told me is all news. So what can we do to try and bridge this gap before we wreck yet another continent with fossil fuels?
Well, I'd love the progressives listening here to begin to think about the climate debt and what sort of solidarity. So let me give you one example. It's not a U.S. example. The U.S. has been exceptionally good with anti-apartheid solidarity during the 70s and 80s. That's when I was studying in Baltimore and in Philadelphia. I learned my politics very much through that movement and African-Americans leading us fighting racism and also an anti-corporate boycott, divestment, sanctions strategy. So the solidarity is in our veins. We know what can be done from Western countries where good people fight their own elites. And I think that would be the spirit, wouldn't it? In Germany, for example, they're recognizing that the genocide of the Namibians, the Herero and the Nama people, by the German colonialists just over 100 years ago, require reparations. And so Germans began by saying, we will give a basic income grant through the Lutheran Church, as well as one of the big unions, IG Metall, the metal workers. And what they did was quite remarkable. They said to, as a pilot, just let's take a village. And the village, like many in rural areas, is mainly populated by women. The men have done their migration to look for jobs. And so they would give everybody, it was only about $10 a month, but it did an enormous amount of good in this place, Ochivero. To me, it was a pilot, Alex, for how the West can indeed start solidaristic work so that you and people like me in the global north here in Johannesburg should start figuring out how a system of climate debt would pay people in especially massively storm and, you know, sort of extreme weather affected areas, drought areas, flooded areas, areas where there's rising seawaters, so that we would start making perhaps that same sort of basic income grant, a cash donation, where people would otherwise not really survive without it. And I think those are the kinds of creative ways forward, these Germans in the Lutheran Church in Ochivero, Namibia, with very good local activists promoting them from Windhoek. It's a basic income grant that can be found on the web. And also, I would say the other way to, again, provide that solidarity, like Yasuni in Ecuador, is to try to find areas where conservation can be confirmed by local progressives, again, with some monetary compensation to people. It's really about how to pay a climate debt, isn't it? And it's not only, as I say, the sort of loss and damage we've been describing, like Durban. It's also adaptation. It's costing a lot to build the stormwater drainage, the better irrigation systems for rural people and so forth. And then also to compensate Africans for not using the atmospheric space. Those are the sorts of messages I hope. And, you know, the most important thing of all, get your governments to force companies to stop emitting. People are recognizing how to do that. It's the contradictions that Joe Biden's politics, Charles Schumer and Joe Manchin coming up with their side deals. You have to watch those guys every moment. And I know there are fantastic climate justice folk all over the United States doing just that. And it was heartening to know that Manchin actually lost at the end of September in trying to cut a deal to open up more federal lands for oil and gas. So more power to all of you who are engaged in those battles.
I think there's just such hypocrisy because there is a reticence among even some Greens in the West to say, yes, we'll pay climate reparations because we know it will go to corrupt African governments. But the corruption is coming right from the World Bank. It's coming right from the multinational corporations. And the products that have to be bought always come back to be purchased from the West, and the extra interest and collapsing currencies always benefit the West. It's very difficult to say how we're going to get around this reparations thing and get the money in the ways that you just described directly to the people who need it, with better drainage ditches, with better shelters, with cooling centers, with all the things people are going to need just to survive this climate change.
Well, that's right, Alex. And the challenge you're putting to us in Africa is to come up with ways around corrupt governments. And certainly there are. And they're often corrupted by multinationals. Just as one reflection, the first action of the provincial governor, right, the equivalent of a U.S. state governor named Sihle Zikalala in Durban, was to arrange that the water tanker that was going out to the communities would actually route first to his own personal house, his mansion. And so that was, he was very embarrassed when that came out. The neighbors nailed him. It was useful to have that reflection of how venal and greedy some of these leaders are. And I think it's at that level where activists in this part of the world, certainly in Zimbabwe, when the cyclone Idai hit and they didn't want the government, the sort of coup government against Robert Mugabe, a guy called Emmerson Mnangagwa and his finance minister, Mthuli Ncube, and they, activists in the Center for Natural Resource Governance said, actually, don't pay the climate debt, don't pay emergency funds to these characters. Here's a whole bunch of civil society forces that really could use it. I think giving people who are desperately hard hit, and there are, of course, systems to do that with relative, you know, accuracy and very small admin fees, basic income grants through, you know, people get funding on the phones these days, and you can easily identify where they're coming from and if they're residents. And we need to set these up. We also need the emergency systems. We have a very good group that goes all over the world based in Durban called Gift of the Givers, a Muslim group. And they're perfectly adequate in receiving funds for emergencies, and they do a better job than any government I've ever seen. And I think it's that, let's say, quality control that the activists on at least the South African and Southern African side are beginning to say, yeah, well, maybe the states we're dealing with, if we give them big funds, they'll actually use it to buy guns and put us down even faster. I think those are good questions. We have to be able to come up with an answer like a basic income grant that would make sure that ordinary people who are terribly affected by these extreme events actually are compensated.
Well, I want to get in a quick plug here for a friend of mine who's a volunteer with the American Red Cross, and she's traveling to the different hurricane zones and the wildfires and finding people burned out and helping them. And they're really short of volunteers, so they're not asking for money. They're asking for people who have the time to show up and help them, and I'll put a lot more about that in my blog. You've been at this a long time, Patrick Bond. How do you look forward? How do you see your own role now?
Well, I'm an armchair academic, always have been, but it's very easy for someone in the middle class to find an extra moment to encourage, to do analysis, to do critical work against the corporates in the state, because there are next generations coming through. So although we still have our, you know, the classic South African left divisions, there's plenty of little, you know, factions, and we have about three or four different climate justice movements. What's really great, and I even saw this on Amy Goodman's show this week, where she highlighted one young South African, and it's, to me, just a terrific, let's say, boost to my own energy and hope that next generations are coming through with exceptional militancy. And I think also a very healthy generational rage. And they're also picking up an issue that when we work on gender and race and LGBTQI and class and all the other ways in which climate is very biased, we're also now being confronted with something that's so profound, it really is the definition of sustainable development, which is future generations. That is, are we screwing up our environment so much now with, for example, extractive industries, the mining sector that's so powerful here, that we're leaving the next generations with huge deficits? And that's definitely the case. And I salute the youth who get angry at our my generation. I'm 61, and it's time for us to look in the mirror and say, well, yeah, future generations are going to be part of our whole set of affected constituencies that need a voice. And we should be listening very carefully to the youth who try to begin to articulate that.
We have been speaking with Professor Patrick Bond from the University of Johannesburg, and I will put a link to his work and his recent co-authored article, How Not to Offer Climate Finance, as published at counterpunch.org. You can find these links and a way to pass on this interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you for coming back here for our listeners.
Well, it's great to be with you. And just two words to end, Alex. The two words are local vernacular in different languages here. They mean power to the people. Mandla. Away to.
Thank you so much. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.